morning in John chapter 9. We have a few handouts from last week if someone needs one. Okay. We've been noting for some time now the seven signs, seven classical signs in the book of John. Before that, if you remember, we dealt with the seven I am statements in John as well. And just as there are really more than seven I am statements, there are more than seven signs. And I repeat myself because of the importance of it. Probably, well, there's no probably, the greatest sign in John is at the end of the book. And that's where Jesus is raised from the dead. That was the sign that was to find its place in the heart of the gospel and to be preached so that men might be saved. All of these others are supplements to that to produce faith in those who might read about them. So we've been talking about how John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31 constitute the key verses, or maybe not the key, but the thesis verses of John chapter 20. John explains to us exactly why he wrote what he did. He said, "Truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." And so these signs were recorded for us to produce faith. And we won't read them all, but we've been going through, and now we're at the sixth sign, number six, the healing of the blind man, chapter 9, verses 1 through 41, shows Jesus as the empowerer of the ordinary. And the last sign, the only one left of the classical seven, is John chapter 11, where Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. So we're getting close to finishing, although we may do something on the resurrection after number seven, if the Lord wills. And verses 1 through 41, the entire chapter, really constitutes or sets forth for us this event and this particular miracle. And just for review's sake, verses 1 through 41, the one thing we have to consider in regard to this discussion is how, like the other signs, they all show Jesus to be the Christ. And oftentimes what he does when he performs the miracles or the signs that he performs, they say something about him truly being Messiah or Christ. These signs are written, why? That you may believe that Jesus is Messiah, that he is the Christ. And so we talked a little bit about some of the Old Testament passages, that when the Messiah would come, the book says, the blind shall see. So why does Jesus heal so many blind folk in his work on earth? Why do we see similar things with the beginning of the church? Because of the messianic age, Jesus proved himself to be Messiah, and then later his followers would produce similar miracles to show that they indeed had been empowered by him. And so we looked at Isaiah 29, Isaiah 35, verses 3 through 6, the eyes of the blind shall be opened. Isaiah 42, verses 6 and 7, he comes to open the blind eyes. And so Messiahship, the fact that Jesus is the Christ, is borne out in this sign. It's interesting. He's come to open blind eyes. And I am free of all sorts of helpful optical devices this morning. I have no contacts. I tried to wear those, and I want to claw my eyes out almost before service has started. I don't know if they've grown old or what. And then the babies continually rip my glasses off my face. And so at some juncture, one of them did it, probably the rotten one. And I laid them down, and I don't know where they are. I have no idea. So got these reading glasses up here. Those are very helpful. Distance isn't as much of a problem, although there's a nice little aura over all of you. It looks almost like we're in heaven, maybe. A little bit of a glow, you know. But it's the small print now that killed me. So anyway, sounds like a personal problem, so we'll move on. All right, so now we're going to talk a little bit about the miracle. We won't read the verses we read last week, but looking at verses 1 to 5, Jesus declares that this man had been born blind, not because his parents had sinned or he had sinned, but for the purpose of God working through him to demonstrate his glory. So the reason, which is spelled out for us by inspiration, that this man had been born blind or allowed to be born blind was that God might work his works in him. Now, we can't point at any situation in life and say, I know exactly why that. No, we don't know that. But in this case, we know why this man was allowed to rise up at this particular point in history and why he suffered the way that he did. Not that God's the author of suffering or pain, but he does allow such, depending on his reasoning and purpose. And in this case, he allowed it regarding this man. And so we talked a little bit about how what Jesus said flew in the face of the theology of the day, where the Jews often believed that sickness or some sort of life misfortune, some catastrophe, was the result of personal sin, or maybe even the sin of parents, and that somehow you were cursed because of it. And we know, as we said, it's possible to suffer serious consequences because of personal sin. But sometimes we suffer, we face sort of all sorts of difficulties, not because of personal sin, but just simply because we live in a fallen world. And that's just the way things go. And that's the way they will go until Jesus comes again, when all of those things will be righted and turned around, and glory will be enjoyed, and all that we're missing out on here will finally receive. So it wasn't because of his sin, but for the glory of God. We talked a little bit about spit and clay. Probably never thought you'd be in a Bible class where you talk about spittle and mud, but that's what we did. And we referenced a little bit about how some think that this, because the blind man was born that way, sight had to be created in him, and so they believe there's a number of allusions to man being created from the dust and so forth and so on. Some see medicinal value in spittle. There's a number of theories behind it. Our resident theologian, Terry Bruce, probably offered the best explanation of it. That's just the way Jesus wanted to do it. So we didn't send him to school for 6 years for any other reason but that. So that may be it. We won't go into all of that. But then verses 8 through 12, once he's healed, his curious neighbors began to ask questions. Why? What's happened here? It was spectacular. And this man, as most who were in similar circumstances would have done, he would have stationed himself near a place of worship like a temple or a tabernacle. And the worshipers would see him again and again as they would go to that place either for the law to be read or for prayer or whatever it may have been. And generally it would be before or after a religious service, a religious observance that people would be in the mood to give because it was the right thing to do. And so it wasn't unlikely or it wasn't anti-typical for somebody like him to be stationed like this. And the point is, these people knew who he was. They act like they don't, or we might draw the conclusion they're thinking, this can't be him, it's just somebody who looks like him. They know that it's him, they just can't explain what's happening. They can't figure out what's going on. So that brings us to verses 13 through 17. And now that this man has been healed of his blindness, on the Sabbath day, the religious leadership gets involved. Have you noticed how many times Jesus performs his miracles, particularly those that would involve works of compassion on the Sabbath day? It was never right or never wrong to do right on the Sabbath. It was never wrong to show compassion. It was never wrong to help. As Jesus would point out on other occasions, as he would dress down the religious leadership, he would say, which of you would not pull his ox or his donkey out of a ditch on the Sabbath? In other words, if your donkey's moving around where you live and falls into a hole, nobody's going to look at that donkey and say, well, we'll just get him out tomorrow. They'd pull him out for compassion, for reasons of compassion. And Jesus points out their inconsistency. Here's a man, or whoever it is that he's healing has been in this condition all this time, and you want him to wait when there's opportunity right now. So he would often perform his miracles on the Sabbath to show their hardness of heart, their inconsistency, and also that he was Lord of the Sabbath. If anybody knew what was to be done on that day, it was Jesus, because as God, he was the one that authored that thing. He wrote it, he legislated it. So if anybody would know, but as we understand and as we found out, the Jews had all kinds of laws that they had formulated based on keeping the Sabbath holy. Not laws that were in the Torah itself, but they would just draw conclusions based on the law itself. Well, this must be so. In other words, no work on the Sabbath. They would say carrying your mat on the Sabbath or your bed is work. Therefore, to carry your bed on the Sabbath is to violate the law. Sounds good, but that's not what the law says. And for one reason, it would cancel out compassion in that kind of situation. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about these Pharisees, verses 13 through 17. The man's already made clear that a man called Jesus made clay and anointed his eyes and said to him, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And he did, and he returned seeing. We talked about his ability to enjoy that blessing of grace. He had to do what the Lord said. He didn't merit anything, but he did what he was told, and he was blessed. Verse 13 now says, they brought him, who formerly was blind, I love that, to the Pharisees. Now it was the Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Therefore some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was division among them. Right there in verses 16 and 17, that's really the heart of the matter. You realize that? Now. They say he broke the Sabbath. That was their conclusion based on their traditions. But the others get it. He can't possibly be breaking the Sabbath, because his power is from God, and if he's a lawbreaker, he's not going to have that power, but he has it. Therefore, he hasn't broken the Sabbath. He's only violated your tradition. That's really the heart of why they should have accepted Jesus, but they don't. They should have said, oh, anybody who can do what he's doing, he must not be violating the Sabbath. Maybe we need to rethink what we've been saying about. Now, here's what is going on here. According to the Pharisees, Jesus may have broken the Sabbath in the following ways. Notice broken is in parentheses there based on their opinion. Since he was not dealing with a life or death situation, Jesus should have waited until the next day to heal the man. What does that cancel out? Compassion. Would you dare tell somebody if you had the opportunity to give them sight, you just have to wait for the morning? That wouldn't even make any sense, would it? If suddenly you had the cure in your hand and you walked over to somebody and you realized you could heal their sight and they know you can't, so we'll just wait till tomorrow. I don't know. Jesus had kneaded the clay with his saliva to make mud, and kneading, in the idea of dough, like kneading for bread, you weren't supposed to prepare things like that on the Sabbath, was it included among the 39 classes of work forbidden on the Sabbath. 39 classes of work the Pharisees had determined were improper on the Sabbath day. Now who determined that? They did. But see, those 39 classes of work became just as solid and concrete as law. Really more so. Really more so. Later Jewish tradition stipulated that it was not permitted to anoint eyes on the Sabbath, although opinion seems to have been divided. I find that interesting. Well, is it or isn't it? See, when we start talking about the traditions of men, what happens? It boils down to what? Opinion. But they really believed Jesus had violated the Sabbath in violating one of their rules. One of their rules. Not a rule found in the law per se, but one of theirs. Well, they want to get the man's parents involved in it, and evidently he's a grown man, but they want to. They're still not sure what's happened here. So looking at chapter 9, verse 18, we have his fearful
parents.
We had some furious Pharisees who are now on the scene. We do. And now his parents are brought in. It says, but the Jews, or let's finish verse 17. We didn't even know. Verse 17, they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him because he opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. He hasn't quite gotten around to who he actually is, because Jesus is not just a prophet. He is what? He is the prophet. But he's getting closer. Verse 18, but the Jews, that's really standing for the Pharisees, did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked him, saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? How does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age. Ask him. So, they're afraid. Now, why would they be so afraid? The Jews did not believe the man's testimony, so they called his parents. It may be that the formerly blind man had lived under their roof. Probably did still. Here's a man who needs a lot of help. It's their son. He's blind. Hard for him to go out and live on his own, make a living, so he probably still does. The parents responded to the Pharisees' interrogation of them by agreeing that he was indeed their son, that he was born blind, but they did not know how he came to receive his sight. The Pharisees would have to ask him about that. He was an adult and able to speak for himself. Actually, however, the parents were hedging in their answer. They apparently knew it was Jesus who healed their son, but they were afraid the Jews would expel them from the synagogue. Now, let's think about that for a minute. How bad is that? It's really bad. Mm-hmm. We might not be able to... We might not be able to really understand the gravity of it as much as we might, as we probably should to some degree, but let's use it from the standpoint. Imagine that you live in a community where basically you're related to everybody, okay? Your people own the stores, the banks, the whole bit, okay? And therefore, your life is intertwined with all of these people. And your ability to get things done, to go to work, all of that has to do with your relationship with these people. And imagine that for some offense, you were then ostracized by all of them. You try to go to the bank, nobody will talk to you. You go to the grocery store, they won't let you buy your groceries. Everybody shuns you, nobody speaks to you. You are a pariah in your society. Think of how difficult that would be. You are cast out of your community. Everybody you've ever been close to, everybody you've ever had relationships with and interacted with and loved, suddenly now they refuse to acknowledge you. That's the same idea because of Jewish communities that we have with the expulsion from the synagogue. Now, in other words, to be expelled from the synagogue, cast out, we might use the phrase excommunicated or disfellowshipped or whatever you want to use, was paramount to losing everything you had. Can you see why they were afraid? Because they were about to become nothing in the sight of their entire community if they didn't respond appropriately to these religious leaders who would seem to it that this happened. Now, when the Bible talks about disfellowship among New Testament Christians, certainly we're not to treat anybody in an inappropriate way. We're to continue to admonish someone who's been withdrawn from as a brother and plead for them to come back home. But disfellowship even in congregations when someone is out of line or out of step is for the purpose of bringing them back, helping them to see what they've lost as far as communities. But oftentimes, because of a lack of closeness in congregations, it doesn't have the same effect as it would if we interacted daily with one another, saw each other all the time, all of our social activities were together. Then it would be a much bigger thing, although it's still appropriate and right. I'm not saying, but it may not have the teeth it ought to have because of our particular cultural situation that we're in. So verses 24 through 34 now, they're going to talk to the blind man. He's not blind anymore, but they're going to talk to him. So they again, verse 24 says, called the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." What are they asking him to do? Okay. But at the same time, they're seeking to get him to acknowledge that Jesus is a fraud. That's really what they're trying to do. There's no way he could have done anything good and right because it's the Sabbath day. So, verse 25, he answered and said, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know," here's that famous line, "that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" So he's getting a little bit miffed about all of this by this point. He answered them, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" Kind of like this guy. He's got a little bit of an attitude. But in the right way. Yeah, you know, it'd be hard to say something bad about the guy that just gave you sight if you've been in the dark all your life, wouldn't it? And he's actually more logical in his thinking than they are. Verse 28, then they reviled him. They ridiculed, they mocked him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from." The man answered and said to them, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from. Yet he has opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." Let's just stop there for a second. Think. Notice the logic he's using. It goes back to what we were talking about just a little while ago, where they were arguing among themselves about the actual sign. He couldn't have broken the Sabbath because of what he did shows he's from God, therefore we need to rethink what we've done. The blind man, who's not schooled in the law like the Pharisees, is more logical than they are. You ever heard of anything like this? You guys are supposed to be in the know, and you don't even know where this guy's from, and he's doing these kinds of things. In a backhanded way, he's really rebuking them, I think. He's used good logic against him. You mean to tell me some guy who's deep in sin, some Sabbath breaker, deserves death, is going around healing people and giving sight to the blind? Do you really think that's possible? Well, here's their response, verse 34. They answered and said to him, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. He's cast out. Notice the statement there. When they say you are completely born in sins, what do they mean?
Yeah.
This isn't the Calvinistic idea of total human depravity and being guilty of even the sin of Adam, blah, blah, blah. This is going back in context to the discussion that Jesus was in with his disciples at the beginning of the chapter. They think, okay, he's blind, then sin is the answer to his problem or the reason for his problem. And so, in essence, they're saying, if you think about it, they're defying the logic, or they're trying to use the same logic against him that he's using against them regarding Christ. Think about it for a minute. They're saying, you can't say anything good. because you're completely born in sin. Implying that if he were good, he wouldn't be a sinner. Jesus has demonstrated good, but he's a sinner. They're so inconsistent. They don't know if they're coming or going. They're so inconsistent in what they're saying. So he's cast out. This refers to the man's expulsion from the synagogue. The way in which this is carried out suggests, and this is interesting, we might not know this, an impulsive and prompt decision rather than the culmination of a formal investigation issuing in a solemn act of excommunication. That's a lot of words right there, but basically what it's saying is this. You didn't just walk up to somebody and say, you're out of here. You didn't walk up to somebody and say, you know, I don't like what you've done or what you've said or what you believe. Therefore, we deem you excommunicated. We cast you out. We expel you. They didn't do it that way. They had a jurisprudent system. They had ways of doing things. They would basically have a trial. Go through the proper motions, make sure everything was in place. The guy was guilty. See you later. If he wasn't, glad you're still with us. That's not how they do it. They become angry when this man doesn't behave as they think he should and say what they think he should say. They just immediately say, you're toast. Reminds you of anything else in the gospel account. You think of any other instance where they behaved similarly? Jesus' trial. Wasn't a trial at all. It wasn't a trial at all. They bypassed almost everything that went along with the proper Hebrew trial to condemn someone. They just, you heard what the man says, he's blasphemed, he's worthy of death. That's how they drew their conclusion. Jesus was he was very dangerous because the Jewish religious leadership of the day, it doesn't matter who we're talking about, certainly the Sadducees and the Herodians, and they were the big shots on the Sanhedrin Council, the guys that generally made all the decisions. But even the Pharisees, to a degree, realized that if they behaved themselves appropriately, they could basically go about their business and not be bothered too much by the Romans. But if someone came along and stood up and declared, I am king of the Jews, that could bring the wrath of the Romans on them, and the Romans could sweep in and destroy everything, and everything they'd ever known would be gone. We'll see that in John 11. Caiaphas prophesied. We can't worry about this one man. We've got to worry about the nation. So this idea of Jesus being the Messiah, although they claimed to long for him, they kind of knew. And Jesus didn't seem to fit the bill that they wanted, so they didn't want Jesus to do too much or cause too much commotion, because that could bring a lot of heat, and they didn't want that to happen. And he was also stripping them of a lot of their popularity. People were now following Jesus rather than these religious leaders. So there's a lot involved that they're concerned about. So they just basically, in a fit of anger, cast him out. The Pharisees' prejudiced procedure of interrogating the blind man and his parents violate their own laws, which stipulate the witnesses are to be examined fairly and without prejudice. Just walk away from all of that. Just walk away from all of that. So now he has his sight, but he's got no community. Verses 35 through 38, belief and worship. It says, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, I love that statement. When the man was cast out, who found him? When the man was down, who went looking for him? He said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? He's already thought of Jesus as a prophet, but now he's going to move a step closer. Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you. Jesus ever claimed to be the Messiah, the Christ? Some scholars say he never did. I think he just did. That's why when they vote about what Jesus actually did say, and I did say when they vote at some of these seminars, they'll oftentimes say, well, Jesus probably didn't say that because he would have never made that claim. Then he said, notice verse 38, Lord, I what? I believe. And he worships him. Is it appropriate to worship Jesus? You better believe it. You better believe it. When John tried to fall down before the angel in the book of Revelation, what did the angel tell him? And, don't worship me, worship God. This man worships Jesus. If he were doing something wrong, what do you think Jesus would have said? Don't worship me. But he doesn't say that. And if the angel in Revelation says worship God, and this man worships Jesus, and Jesus doesn't say anything, what's the conclusion? He's God. He possesses the divine nature. Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. So what did this sign produce in the man born blind? It produced life in Jesus' name, didn't it? Just exactly what these signs were for. This one produced faith in the man who experienced it. We, on the other hand, will increase in faith, come to faith, by reading what happened to the man. Yes,
sir. I see another story in this too, when he's talking about him being a cast out Jews themselves and losing that. But I can't help but think, not too long after this, I'm still around, you know, about another community, the church.
Sure. And who would this man, you think, who do you think he would have partnered with after this? Other disciples of Jesus, those who were following Jesus wherever he went. He really didn't need the synagogue anymore. I'm sure it was still painful, don't you? But he found a new community, even then, that was in prospect, would become the community of Christ to the church. And there's actually quite a... There's parable involved in this. There's some interesting twists. Notice that the text ends with the Pharisees being likened to blind guides. So this sets up a parable. Notice 39 through 41. That is an earthly story that has a heavenly meaning to it, an earthly event. Verse 39, and Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say we see, therefore your sin remains." That sounds rather cryptic, doesn't it? But what's he basically saying? You are responsible, you know better, and you have chosen to reject me anyway. So spiritually, you're blind. So we have a blind man who sees, and we have a bunch of men who claim to see. By the end of the text, Jesus says, "You are blind as bats." I added the "as bats" in there. You won't find that in any translation or any paraphrase that I'm aware of. Questions? We talked about in the sermon last week from 2 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4, that the gospel is powerful, but for some, the God of this age blinds their heart. Well, whose fault is that? They simply allow the God of this age to do it. But there are a lot of people who walk around in spiritual blindness. And it's not because there's not enough things, there's not enough balm or medicine to heal their blindness. They just reject it. They don't want it. It's like a man who has some sort of malady and he refuses to cure even though the cure's there. And it all should have been what pointed them to him. Kochenberger, one of my favorite commentators on John, said, "For the man born blind, this healing restored his sight. One thing I know, I was blind but now I see. But for John, the event also serves as a parable illustrating the condition of human blindness brought about by sin and spiritual pride." These Pharisees didn't want to think that what they believed and had put together regarding the Sabbath day could possibly be wrong. The Pharisees are quick to conclude that Jesus is a sinner because, in their view, he broke the Sabbath. But they are slow to find fault with themselves, haughtily claiming to be disciples of Moses. They are blind, even though they say they see. Well, if the Lord wills, we'll look at John 11 next week. If you want to read through that a little bit, to about verse 44, I think. You can read through the whole chapter, though. You can read the whole book of John. Not 2 John, but the whole book, if you'd like, as James talked about. And it'll be a blessing to you.